Blaise Cathcart, QC. I'm a former Judge Advocate General of the Canadian Armed Forces. That was between 2010 and 2017. But I had a long legal career of 27 years as a legal officer within the Office of the JAG. I retired in September 2017 as a Major General. And it was the most honorable and privileged thing I had the chance to do, and I would do it all over again if I could.
Welcome to a podcast called Intrepid. My name's Craig Forsees. I'm here with Stephanie Carvin, once again in the observation room of the University of Ottawa courtroom. And today we have a new pod site with Blaise Cathcart, former Judge Advocate General.
And also, I have to say, former LSE student with me. Way back in the day, we took international law with Chris Greenwood. I always like to throw that in there. The difference is, of course, Blaise won the award for being the top student that year, and I was just auditing the class. So we're clearly on different levels, but he's one of the sharpest legal minds in Canada, and it's great that we had the opportunity to talk to him about actually a large amount of topics, everything from what C-59 means for the military all the way through to Syria.
And we got to argue at the end.
Yes, we have our first Intrepid podcast law off.
So for the three or four of you who will stay to the back end of that legal debate, without further ado, Blaise Cathcart. Well, thanks for joining us today, Blaise.
Yeah.
We thought that we might, in the course of this podcast, give our listeners a sense as to what it is the JAG does. Most people probably have heard the term JAG. Some may associate it with a certain TV show from south of the border. But this is our opportunity to communicate the functions of the JAG within our national security and defense establishment, as well as to touch upon some of the contemporary issues that have arisen, especially in the area of international law and law of armed conflict and some of the associated issues. And so why don't we start, Blaise, by just describing what it is that the JAG does. You have a statutory footing now, the JAG does.
Yeah, that's quite true, Craig. So yeah, under Canadian law, and well, let me back up one saying, yeah, many people, when they do hear the term JAG, they tend to associate it with the famous TV show South of the Border, which actually, when I first joined in 1990, was became a major recruiting tool inadvertently, because that people started saying, what is this JAG thing? And often ask, is it, you know, what you do, is it just like the JAG show? And I said, it's exactly like that. I have my, you know, F-14 Tomcat parked outside, and when I need a witness for a court-martial, I jump in it and go get it. But no, but it did help bring some profile. But yeah, I think it's an area that certainly, as JAG, I tried a great deal to help inform and educate the wider legal community in Canada, certainly, but also the general public, because it is a bit of an unknown. But you're right, the JAG is established by statute under the National Defense Act. Through that, Parliament has essentially given JAG two main roles. One is to be military, to advise on military law, basically to the upper echelons of government, the executive, including the Governor General, obviously the government, the Minister of National Defence, the Department of National Defence, and the Canadian Armed Forces, primarily the Chief of Defence Staff. Parliament didn't do us the favor in the Act of defining what military law is. So we've basically built upon practice. The position of JAG in Canada was actually established in 1911. So it's not a new position. And so we built upon that. And what we've done is taking what I'll call the practice of military law, and we broke it down into three main pillars. Those being military justice, what we call operational law, and what we call military administrative law. And I can go into those more detail if you would like later. The other major role for the JAG that Parliament has given the JAG is to be the superintendent of the administration of the military justice system. It's another bit of an unknown for most Canadians. The military justice system, I refer to as Canada's other justice system. It is on the same constitutional footing. It's recognized in the Charter under Section 11F. But, you know, obviously in comparison to the civilian criminal justice system, we're much smaller. But in terms of how it functions, there are many similarities in the system. Obviously, the one thing that distinguishes military justice and why there is a separate system and why the Supreme Court of Canada has consistently recognized the need for a separate system is the concept of discipline. Discipline is what ultimately separates the members of Canadian Armed Forces from civilian society in terms of how they behave and how they they react to the concept, because we need troops to react very instantly in pressure situations. You do that by instilling discipline. Many tools to do that, but one of the key ones is military justice. So essentially those are the two key areas of roles and responsibilities given to the JAG. Now, interestingly enough, the JAG is one of two positions in the Canadian Armed Forces that is a governor and council appointment, the other being the chief of defense staff.
And just for our audience, that's the cabinet, the governor and council's cabinet. So basically, the prime minister gets to pick. It's established that way. Sorry, that's my
No, that's fine. Yeah, it's often referred to as an executive appointment.
Right.
The so what about that is Parliament has created that very intentionally so that JAG can remain independent of the chain of command in providing legal advice, and that is critical to the role. Obviously, JAG is a member of the Canadian Armed Forces, wear a uniform, have rank, and follow all the general rules and regulations. But when it comes to your duties and functions to provide legal advice and act as the superintendent of the military justice system, you cannot be directly ordered, even by the chief of defense staff, to say, I want this particular legal opinion. Unlike some of our allies, like the United States, who are often referred to as staff judge advocates because they're on the staff of the commander, and although they have ethical ways to protect themselves, they don't have the same statutory protection that the JAG has in Canada. So that's very critical that people understand that was done very intentionally. It's sometimes perceived as JAG, bringing all this independence and powers upon him and himself. That's not the case. Parliament did that very intentionally. And in order to do that, Parliament has also created, the office of the JAG to help the JAG do his or her duties. When I was there doing that particular function, it was a fairly large office, 300 people in total. It includes some civilians that work across here and across the country. We have many offices across the country, but primarily it's with the legal officers who numbered roughly about 165 regular full-time and about 45 reserve force, which are considered part-time folks that have other legal jobs and do part-time work for us. And all of that was, of course, geared to fulfill the JAG's roles and responsibilities that I've described, which ultimately point to the main goal, which is to support the Canadian Armed Forces in, successful mission accomplishment terms.
So just to be clear here, the Judge Advocate General is not a judge. I've seen some people in the media and elsewhere talk about the Judge Advocate General being a judge. There are military judges, but the Judge Advocate General is not one of them.
Correct.
And the other aspect is that you're essentially the law firm for the Canadian Armed Forces, which means that you are providing independent legal advice as apart from the Department of Justice, which tends to be the legal services provider for the rest of government.
Right.
And so that would put you in one of the tripartite systems. We have justice, we have you at JAG, and we also have the legal advisor at Foreign Affairs, which also provides independent legal advice. Am I right about that?
You're spot on, and those are two great points. That number one, yes, even though the term has Judge Advocate General, it's a historical title that dates back to the creation of the military law system within the UK, and has carried through. I believe Canada, maybe United States, are still the two remaining countries that still retain the title, but doesn't make it, as you said, a judge. We have separate military judges. Some people, comment upon that as misleading or somehow a mischaracterization. I'm not going to debate that. It's a functional title. It never interfered one way or another in terms of being able to fulfill my functions, nor did it impact on anybody else realistically thinking I was acting as a judge in any capacity. But the emphasis is, on more of the, like you said, the advocacy role in that context. So that's an important point, because a lot of people would think, well, you're the top judge in Canada. And there was a time pre-1998 when the JAG had certain, what I would call quasi-judicial functions that would, make it more akin to a judge's role. But those have long been removed from the JAG's power. And you're quite right. Where does the JAG fit within the broader legal advisor community within the government of Canada? And it's been a challenge at times, I'll be honest, because you do have those two other entities, the Department of Justice, legal advisors, and of course the Global Affairs Canada now legal advisor. I would actually add to the mix that there is a legal advisor function. It's not as well known and not always used strictly in that way within the Office of the Privy Council. And that's populated mostly by Department of Justice lawyers, but we've had some JAG officers working there. We do currently as well. I have to say I remember I'm retired now and not so much in that context, so I'll apologize once in a while. But
play Cathcart, unplugged.
That's it, citizen Cathcart now. But yeah, absolutely, and that poses a challenge because, especially with Department of Justice, who, you know, I always lovingly call the big legal dog on the block, who have, as you may be aware, they have legal services units within all departments, including Department of National Defense, although that was relatively new, created in 1998. And so how do you divide, those areas of responsibilities when Parliament hasn't, really put a fine point on defining what is your area? So there have been challenges for sure, both for international legal issues and domestic legal issues. We've done, obviously, as Canadians would expect, we work very closely professionally with both of those other legal advisors to come to a consensus. But, there have been more than one occasion on serious issues where we've disagreed. And so, then it's just up to the decision makers to take all that advice and decide, which advice they prefer to act upon or not act upon.
So on an issue, say, a use of force, an international deployment involving use of force, which engages both the domestic and international legal issues, I would suspect that you'd have opinions from certainly JAG, opinions from the legal advisor at Global Affairs, and Justice as well weighing in. And so you have the prospect of an American-style inter-department consolidation process.
Yes, we do. I mean, again, if we're dealing strictly with, the Canadian Armed Forces international deployment, then, the sort of general practice has developed that JAG will be sort of the lead advisor on those issues, particularly, things like use of force, rules of engagement, targeting, those types of things. And then, obviously if they have a broader impact and, with modern day operations, and this kind of goes to your opening comment about where does it fit within the national security and defense world? Well, again, even when I joined in 1990, I was never particularly, sort of sold on the idea that there is a clear, bright line between national defense issues and what is termed national security. And I would say certainly since a 9/11 scenario that national security has moved much more closely to encompass national defense as a key component of it, particularly in practical terms, not only on the legal advisor side, but the operators, the folks that have to go do the business, intelligence sharing that you know quite a bit about, both of you. You can't have those compartmentalized structures that we used to have because you need to be able to share that information to create a more fulsome picture of the threats and then how to react to those. So within that, yes, if there's a broader national security issue, and some of the missions, we do have obviously other government players involved in this, Communication Security Establishment and CSIS. So, when they're on missions, they work quite closely with Canadian Armed Forces members. So we do have to make sure that in order to ensure all actors are understanding the legal frameworks, particularly when it comes to issues like use of force, we do have to coordinate with those other players that we mentioned. But yes, it can get frustrating at times for all involved because there are differing views, just with, even in private practice, different lawyers look at things differently. Within government, that can happen. And the best you can do is offer your best advice. And again, let the decision makers, whether they be military uniform decision makers or civilian government actors, to make those final calls.
You mentioned that there's this distinction in terms of chain of command between the officers in the field and the JAG. The JAG officers are also deployed in many instances, I understand, with units of the Canadian Armed Forces.
Yep.
And so they will participate in some of the assessment on targeting, I assume, from a legal and also from the terms of engagement perspective.
Yes.
So how does that work? Let's assume that you've got an artillery issue and the commanding officer wants to say, we're going to fire X number of rounds in a such and such location. And that issue then is going to be an international humanitarian law assessment. And so does the JAG officer sit at the elbow of that command officer and provide advice?
Yeah, the short answer is yes. And again, that's what the opportunity to describe this for all folks, your listeners and Canadians, because I think that's a bit of a great unknown that I think if Canadians understood more, they, if they're not feeling comfortable about, those things being legally reviewed, they should feel a lot more comfortable because we do have JAG officers deployed. Just to back up, so in any given mission, particularly where use of force is likely, you know, particularly like one in Afghanistan or operations in Iraq where you're actually involved in
Libya
in an armed conflict, using that. You know, in the planning process, when the Chief of Defense Staff is giving his directions on planning, there will always be a portion where he creates what he calls a strategic targeting directive or guidance from the Chief of Defense Staff. That reminds everybody, because we train on this all the time, reminds everybody to use your teams, what we call targeting teams. So at every, what we call operational level, the tactical, that would be the commander, you know, in the theater of operations, the operational level, which is the next headquarters up, that can be co-located in the same region or back here in Canada, the commander of Joint Operations Command here in Ottawa, and then ultimately the strategic level, the Chief of Defense Staff level. At all levels, they're created these strategic or these targeting teams that will include legal officers, that will include obviously operators, intelligence officers, policy advisors, and any other specialists that you might need, you know, given a particular region or target. So always there's a targeting list that's often created by, I'll say, the coalition or NATO force. If we're working in that context, it's pretty rare for Canada to be doing those types of operations on its own. Although, to the credit of the current Chief of Defense Staff, General Jonathan Vance, he is trying to create a in Canada, you know, from head to toe targeting process. What I mean by that is it would include all the technical pieces that we don't currently have developed, like targeteering and using computer modeling and all those things. For a lot of that, we would still have to rely on allies to do that. So often a lead ally like the United States would develop target lists and give those to the various supporting countries and nations and their commanders. At that point, we just don't open them up and go, oh, that's what our target is, let's go do it. We do a national review, as I've just described, with those teams.
So that's what I was going to, that was actually where I was going to ask, because there's one more layer on this, which is, of course, the international, because, and not in terms of just international law, I mean, Canada never fights alone. We're always fighting with our allies, right?
Yep.
That's how we tend to fight. So can you talk about, you know, what's often described as like legal interoperability in these kinds of operations? Like how are these kinds of things discussed and debated to the extent that you can talk about it?
Yeah, well, yeah, I'm always conscious of obviously security and also my obligations with solicitor-client privilege information. So I'll stay clear of that. But, you know, in very general terms, it's, you know, no matter the type of mission, you're always ended up going to work in an international mission I'm focusing on. You're always going to work with another country, usually an ally, a NATO ally or Western ally, but sometimes others as well. And when it comes to legal issues, not just use of force, a variety of legal issues, even how to deal with your own troops in terms of discipline, it's very necessary not only for commanders to understand, you know, what troops are there and what are their legal constraints and restraints, to use those terms. So we help the commanders do that by, again, deploying legal officers, not necessarily on every mission, depends on the type and quantity of missions, but I can certainly say, you know, any major, you know, war-fighting mission, many Canadian Special Forces missions, even though they're small in numbers, they do very sensitive things. So we would deploy legal officers there. We've deployed legal officers on board Her Majesty's vessels when they're sailing on missions for, say, for example, counter-drugs or counter-piracy. Again, that's just one ship, but we need to have a legal advisor aboard. And if you're then combining that with the broader mission of allies, whether it's a UN, NATO, or other coalition structure, those nations will almost inevitably have their own legal advisors. Our good friends south of the border, the United States, usually have a lot. They arrive, like always, with a thud, like the U.S. always does, and I say that lovingly. They come in, and we immediately, if you, in many cases, you know the people anyway. That's part of your sort of in-between mission process, is to maintain good professional and working relationships. So you often will know people, and so that helps a great deal, as it does in civilian life. So you'll show up and immediately, you know, start focusing on those key issues, use of force. So the commander of the overall mission will need to know what nations, you know, what can they do? What constraints do they have? You know, if you use Afghanistan, for example, certain nations like Germany, very restrictive in both their tasks and the use of force that they believe they could use in those circumstances. So, you know, how do you figure that out? And often, whether it's a UN mission or a NATO, you know, that host organization will create in this case, a targeting directive as well, and a rules of engagement package. We will then, like other nations, review those and then look at things that we say we can do or not do. Because again, it's virtually impossible to have one clean document that can be interpreted legally, let alone from an operational perspective, across the board, especially if you've got combination of common law and civil law nations, and what's their background on key topics like self-defense and collective self-defense. But I can say from personal experience as well that you sit down and you hammer it out and you come to an agreement that will work for the commander, so that he or she then knows, okay, I can count on Canada or this country to be able to do this task with this level of force. And again, I think it's critical that Canadians really do understand that. It's not just operators purely on their own deciding, hey, this is the use of force, and I'm not sure if it matches up with, that commander or that country's. There's a lot of really hard lifting and work done to make sure those things are done, because ultimately, it's those young men and women, particularly on the ground at the combat pointy end, to use that term, that really need to have the confidence that they've got, the law working for them, even though in most cases the technical aspects they'll never have to know or see. But how does it translate down in operational terms? And then, it's tough enough in a Canadian-only context sometimes, but you add in other nations' perspectives and you say, well, troops will often say, well, how come we can do this but they can't? So that's why you have, again, a legal officer in theater there to also not only help the commander, but help the troops understand what they're doing and the differences between them.
So one of the things you also discussed kind of in the first part of this podcast or pod site was the idea of working together with domestic, other departments, agencies, and things like this. So one of the new things that's going to be happening to D&D is that some of its operations are going to be subject to review by this new National Security Intelligence Review Agency under Bill C-59. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering how, from your perspective, and you're retired now, so I don't know if you can go further, what are the challenges of that going to be for D&D?
It's also the Parliamentary Committee as well, under the National Security Intelligence Committee of Parliamentarians, who have a mandate.
Exactly. So a lot of that was obviously, being evolved and developed in my last sort of days as the Judge Advocate General. So I can't comment in great detail about that. I can certainly say that it's going to be a challenge. It's going to be a challenge for all, not just the Canadian Armed Forces and Department of National Defence, but all the security agencies, because it's really a different beast to deal with. I certainly appreciate the government's perspective and why in Parliament, why they would want to create these bodies to have that, what I'll call in a broad sense, oversight of intelligence activities. But it will be a challenge, particularly because as a general rule, and this is not just in the area of intelligence, I find it across sort of many operational lines, that the folks back in Canada, what I'll call the departmental folks, but even some of the oversight bodies, and it's not a criticism, it's just the reality of how they tend to look through things. And again, this includes departmental advisors like Department of Justice legal advisors tend to view a lot of the operations, the international operations, through a domestic law prism. And the so what about that is you're very then focused on Canadian law, the charter, obviously jurisprudence, policies. And don't get me wrong, I'm not saying that's not a critical part. You have to do that. But when you're looking at it that way, it's fun. Sometimes it's the challenge from a Canadian Armed Forces perspective has been trying to get people to better understand that there's also an international law framework here that allows Canada to do a number of certain things, particularly in the area of military operations. So if you use, for example, things like the law of armed conflict, which is governs the way you conduct hostilities in armed conflict, largely composed of the Geneva Conventions that people might be familiar with and other treaties. There are many things within that law of armed conflict that if you're not really one experienced of from giving advice on, or even not understanding them just from a more academic perspective, then you tend to default to, at home, for example, a use of force. Well, how would a police officer use force in this situation? That's not the model you apply to a soldier in an armed conflict using it. Similarly with other aspects, intelligence. What you can do in an armed conflict to gather and use intelligence can often be much more broad from an operational and legal perspective. perspective than what might be created, you know, from a domestic perspective. I use example of things, and you know, our good colleagues at CSIS know this better than I do, is, you know, if you're trying to gather intelligence extraterritorial outside of Canada, do you need to ask yourself, well, do I need a warrant to do that? They went down a certain path, and the courts have spoken that essentially, yeah, you kind of do. Whereas in the military, that's not something we would instinctually look at, because that's not the way military operations, particularly interoperating operations, you deal with other nations, and you're all working together under the one mission banner to gather intelligence, to share it in order to, you know, ultimately have mission success. So when you then add onto that this oversight, and you know, oversight was, you know, you have, everybody has a perspective. Was it good enough? Was it bad enough? But there were levels of oversight and review, and certainly the military had that. I think what will be a challenge for the military is a lot of that oversight was really from an internal perspective, if I could use that. So we had a chain of command oversight, you know, because there are ethical and legal requirements for the chain of command to review the work of subordinates. But also then, you know, at the government political level, the minister, who is ultimately accountable to Parliament and through cabinet, you know, oversight in that. Obviously, you always have courts available to look at that. But unlike, you know, some of the other agencies, CSE and CSIS, RCMP, we didn't have that direct body always looking, like CIRC, for example. Security Intelligence Review Committee would look at the activities, more of those folks, and tend to look at them, as I said, through a domestic legal perspective. How that is now going to work, you know, in terms of reviewing. And I know the Canadian Armed Forces has, you know, has had some concerns about, you know, how is this really going to work, particularly in the midst of an operation, when you're trying to, you know, deal with an enemy like the ISIS or Al-Qaeda or the Taliban, and you've got, you know, intelligence sharing going on with allies. How are these new, you know, bodies, or how are they going to do it? Obviously, they'll have, you know, there's a learning process for the bodies as well. And I think that's the biggest challenge, is early on. How's it going out? Obviously, you know, it's based on, I think, the government looking around the world and seeing other nations that have similar type structures that certainly don't seem to cause, you know, a particular mission to, you know, stop in the midst of it from happening. But how do you balance the operational requirements, often, you know, in real time, quick time scenarios, with the ability for these new bodies to be able to say, well, wait a minute, you know, what exactly are you doing here? So I think that's going to be a big challenge for everyone, but I think particularly the military, because they have not had a you know, long experience with such a body, you know, wanting to look at it. And again, my early sense was that in the formulation of a lot of these concepts and potential terms of reference for these bodies, there wasn't a lot of thought, you know, really given to the military. You know, there was a sense that everybody who collects intelligence is going to be included, and the military collects defense intelligence. But, you know, I was never that convinced that, you know, the formulators of the concept really understood what defense intelligence was. You know, fair enough to scoop it up, but that remains, I think, you know, an area that we'll see how that develops.
Do you think if these bodies are given proper expertise and support, maybe by, I don't know, former retired Jedi generals or other people who have experience working in the military, do you think that would help ameliorate that?
Yeah, well, you know, I am retired. I am available. No, shameless. But, I think they're here to stay. You know, that's a reality. So let's see, you know, how they do their work. I guess the piece that all, you know, concerns operators a lot, and you've seen it even with other countries which have been at this particular sort of concept a little bit of time now, is it's, you know, there's always going to be, I think, that little hesitation about the political aspects of these things. You know, how much can you trust people with the information at the end of the day? I think as long as those engaged in that process, you know, take it deadly seriously, and I mean that those two terms in underlining them, then I you know, they'll be professional, they'll be mature, and they'll deal with it, and, you know, everybody will be coming from the same basis that, you know, we just want to make sure everybody's protected from a national security defense perspective, but we also want to make sure that, you know, proper law and policies are being followed, and nobody's straying from that. But how you get there right now is you know, you're kind of standing at the cliff trying to judge that. It's going to be tough. I do think it can happen. Unfortunately, you know, you can start to see, I think, some of the concern that might manifest itself. I think for the most part, other nations have shown it can be done. There is that level of professionalism, maturity amongst parliamentarians or other independent bodies. But there are occasions, and I think, you know, seeing what's going on with, you know, Intelligence Committee south of the border again, you know, with the look at the Russia incidents, you know, you can see how it can devolve very quickly into quite partisan politics, and that serves nobody well, and actually undermines, I think, the very goals that they were appointed to do. So the minute, again, you're going to bring in that extra layer, some sort of oversight that has a political aspect to it, I think there's always going to be a bit of unease from those working in I'll use this example of the intelligence industry, about, you know, what how's this actually going to turn out at the end of the day. So yeah, we'll have to see. I think there's great potential for such bodies, but it would, you know, I think it's going to be very critical to make sure they get off on the right foot.
Yeah. Please, let me ask you a question. I don't know if you can answer this, because this is another question stemming from Bill C-59, but just to riff off a very amusing question that your friend and my friend Alan Kessel, legal advisor at Foreign Affairs, now Global Affairs, once asked, should those directing drone attacks be wearing uniforms? And so let me ask this question. Now that we're seeing the communication security establishment having a broader remit, providing assistance to the Canadian Armed Forces, now formally under statute, potentially doing active cyber, potentially active cyber in an armed conflict situation, mm-hmm. should the people running those computers be wearing uniforms?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, from a legal perspective, the underlying concept that you're referring to is really under the law of armed conflict. In order to participate in the hostilities, there are only certain ways to participate, and I use the terms lawful combatants. So, you know, when you look under Geneva Conventions and additional protocols, it lays out criteria for those engaged in the hostilities who can then lawfully participate. What I mean by that is they have the sanction of state and international law to direct the use of force or actually apply the use of force to kill, capture, you know, those who are designated as the enemy. Then there are categories, other smaller categories, individuals who can participate, you know, an old term called levy en masse, where you have civilians who, you know, the old sense that I can see the enemy literally coming over the hill across the border at us. I'm going to pick up my arms and my pitchfork and fight them right now. They're considered to be lawful combatants. But then there's another category, and, you know, maybe you might invite me back for future podcasts, because there's many topics. And I heard your recent recent comments on the recent Syria attacks as well, and I'd like to address those at some point.
Sure.
Maybe not today.
Yeah.
But anyway, so you have a term, and, you know, again, lawyers and academics will debate the terms. I prefer the term called unlawful combatant. And we heard that a lot, particularly in the case of these non-state actors like ISIS and Taliban, Al-Qaeda, who obviously are taking a direct part in hostilities, but don't have a state sanction to do so. And again, we'll come back for another podcast or two, perhaps, to debate that specifics. But essentially, you have that category. So if you're not sanctioned by the state to use that term from a legal perspective, then you can be objectively considered an unlawful combatant. You're taking parts, whether you're, you know, pressing a computer button in Ottawa to direct a cyber attack overseas, or, you know, flying a drone and directing the attack. In fact, these very debates, as I know both of you folks know, have come up in the context of the Americans, particularly with the CIA activities. And I think a fair starting position to say, well, aren't they unlawful combatants like the very people you're capturing? And I would say from a starting position that they appear to be so. So what you then have to do, though, is there are ways in which people can become lawful combatants. There are provisions, for example, to bring organizations that are might be paramilitary, like police and RCMP and Carabinieri, right. In Italian, formally under the umbrella of defense control during an armed conflict, and therefore give the authorization that they can be lawful combatants. In the case of civilians, and this is a challenge, and the Canadian Armed Forces has given a lot of attention and thought to it, particularly in the areas that you've identified, Craig, of cyber activities and drone activities. I think from a legal advisor's perspective, yes, for clarity, as all lawyers, the Holy Grail, clarity, strive for, the easiest way would be make sure that those individuals who are, I'll use the term pulling triggers, are uniformed, because then the debate is over. They would be lawful combatants in that circumstance. If they are civilians who are doing it, then yes, you have to certainly think about their status, and more so in real terms for those who might be involved in that. And we've certainly run into that over the years. Those who are doing it may not, again, this goes back to my earlier comment about how at home things get looked at through the prism of domestic law. They're not thinking, sitting perhaps in a comfortable or semi-comfortable basement somewhere, of hitting a computer button, that I'm now taking part in hostilities over there, and now I'm subject to the law of armed conflict. How does that work? And so if you're going to go down that route, you have to create the roles and responsibilities such that the individuals are not going to be, unlawfully taking part in hostilities, and also ensuring that they fully understand. Because unlike uniformed folks, civilian folks, sort of get a choice whether they're going to do things or not. And if you're fully advised that, hey, if you do this, this may be, someday. Now, the odds of somebody capturing you in Canada from the theater of operations overseas are slim and maybe none. But as lawyers, that's not your answer. Your answer is they've got to comply with the law of armed conflict, and therefore you must create an environment where the individuals are going to be fully covered by the law, and then work, as we do with soldiers, to make sure that they understand that they are indeed covered by the law.
Do you foresee the CSC operators who engage in what's going to be called active cyber operations needing law of armed conflict training?
Absolutely. In fact, I know we have provided it to them already over the years. It's already public knowledge that primarily CSE and CSIS have been engaged overseas in activities in our armed conflict in Afghanistan and with the activities in Iraq. Once this education piece that I've harped on a few times, it's internal as well, not just for the public, but internally to make sure that governments, ministers, deputy ministers, all those understand what you're now committing Canada, not just the Canadian Armed Forces, to. And if you're using individuals that you've described, Stephanie, who work within civilian organizations, then, not only is it's I think morally and ethically, essentially, to teach them, I argue there's a legal obligation to inform them about the law of armed conflict, and so they understand what their rights and responsibilities are.
Okay, Blaze, you open the door. Syria. We got a few minutes left.
Well done, Craig. Well done. Just a few minutes, huh? Yeah. So when we talked about Syria, I was talking about the recent attacks,
right,
by the US, UK, and the French last Friday, I believe it
right,
was.
Right, which
now.
We did our podcast episode 32.
Yeah, and I heard the tail end of it, which was really that portion, I think. And clearly you were unequivocal in stating that there is no international legal basis for that. I respectfully disagree.
Okay.
I'm absolutely convinced that there is that the concept that we were really debating was, is there a right outside of the charter? You did your analysis, the United Nations Charter, that is, yeah. When you go through your analysis of, not attack nations, essentially, I'm paraphrasing Section 2.4, and then stay away from internal activities, Section 2.7. What are the exceptions? Self-defense, Article 51, and then, of course, Security Council authorization under a Chapter 7 operation. Are there exceptions? And this is really the acorn of debate amongst mm-hmm. folks, primarily practitioners and academics, about whether there are. I believe there are, and I believe perhaps more than others that there is a customary legal authorization under the right of humanitarian intervention to use force to protect You know, to use the best example is the UK criteria. And as you've acknowledged, you know, I've always tipped my hat to the United Kingdom for putting that out there. They've certainly taken a lot of criticism, particularly from a lot of academics in the UK and Europe about that. But I think it's far better. And frankly, I you know, sort of would encourage the Canadian government to do that more often as well as our other allies, the US, as they in this case, where he had many nations come out in support of the attacks by the UK, US and French. But then, you know, leaving open, obviously, from their language, whether that's the same as saying, well, we support the UK legal analysis that they provided, which has basically the three criteria. You know, there's convincing evidence of, you know, as I'm paraphrasing again, a significant humanitarian distress that requires the action, and there's no objectively no other recourse but the use of force.
And proportionality.
And it's necessity. Proportionality yeah. and necessity. Yeah. I believe those have been established, and I believe they've been established in customary law through state practice.
But the opinioiuresis issue is the real one, right?
Well, it is.
And hence your reference to the absence of any kind of legal justification behind these sort of open-ended political endorsements.
Sure, but I think, and I think that's where we ultimately may differ, Craig, right. and others, is I think that's far too rigid of a legal analysis, simply to say, unless you come out and conclusively say, this is our legal opinion and this is it, that opinioiuresis doesn't exist. States rarely do that anyway. Mm-hmm. I mean, the UK is often in isolation in doing those types of things. So even under, if, let's say it was a more, let's say, traditional or more accepted approach like Article 51 self-defense or an authorization, you know, anyone who's been around those issues know that those are fraught with debates all the time. Mm-hmm. You know, what is there a customary right of self-defense outside of Article 51? I mean, that debate is still out there. You look at even when it is authorized by the Security Council, what does that mean? Libya. Libya was, you know, sort of the zenith, if you will, of many from the responsibility to protect R2P world, saying, aha, we finally achieved that, you know, that authorization.
With the Security Council.
With a Security Council blessing. Yeah. And today there's still rabid debate about whether NATO went too far in the using all reasonable force necessary to achieve the humanitarian goals there. So, I think that's just the nature of the legal business, whether it's domestic interpretation or international, is that you're going to have to decide, okay, what am I comfortable with? But I think if you're you know, quite rigid in saying, well, only, you know, 2-4 and only the two exceptions, and only opiniuiresis exists when a state comes out and clearly says this is our legal opinion, you know, I think that's ignoring a lot of what states are just doing. I mean, when you look at many examples, you know, the main ones, of course, being Kosovo, probably the biggest modern example of sort of unilateral, if you will, intervention on a humanitarian law basis. And even there, again, it was largely, if my recollection serves me, only the UK that sort of came out and said, you know, the same criteria that they're using today in Syria, they created there. But other nations, including Canada, just came out and said, you know, not only do we support it, but they actively participated in the bombing. And I was a legal officer involved in that mission at the time. So when you're judging opiniuiuresis, I mean, I think it is fair to say, well, what are states doing? And if states believe they're acting a certain way and other states, many, in fact, I mean, the North Atlantic Council in this case, the European Union in this case all came out and support it without saying specifically.
Which is sort of double counting.
Well, but that's politics too, right? I mean, these are geopolitical issues. Yeah. And a lot of it can, you know, as a lawyer, you know, we all, as I said earlier, we all want clarity, precise clarity. I mean, you know, who's more frustrated dealing with United Nations Security Council resolutions than legal advisors to governments, because no two resolutions are the same.
So if it is, let's stipulate for the sake of argument, it is custom. How do you slot that into the UN Charter framework then? I mean, so 2-4 is a peremptory norm, all right? And so now you've arguably, by your interpretation, there's an international humanitarian intervention customary norm. How can you reconcile that with the 2-4, which is supposed to trump? And is this now going to turn into a Vienna Conventional Law of the Treaties interpretation of 2-4, that there's been an adjustment in terms of its scope that now accommodates
Yeah, I don't, you know, this is another long-standing debate. So I'll try to give
this.
I know. Well, I mean, that is the short answer. I mean, look, the same thing happened in Kosovo, after Kosovo. And the same, so, you know, 10 plus years later, we're back at the same spot that we thought we had moved on to, particularly with the creation, Canadian-inspired creation of R2P. I think the short answer is, you know, I'm not known any serious, scholar who would look at it and say 2-4 trumps customary law. I think Dapo Okande from Oxford has done that with his recent legal opinion for the Labour Party in the UK, condemning the UK legal advice, saying, well, you know, 2-4 and Article 103 of the UN Charter, which obliges folks that if there's a conflict with law. Bingo. He doesn't say treaties. He just says the law, and he assumes customary law. So I assume that customary law exists, just like as it does in the area of self-defense.
Yeah, but 2-4 is also customary, right?
Nicaragua
case. Sorry, it's clearly.
But it's also, you know, as we all do as lawyers, you look at this particular facts of the case. I think you can distinguish Nicaragua in the time, because at that time the International Court of Justice (ICJ) said under these particular facts, the U.S. trying to assist for humanitarian reasons doesn't fly. But we've seen examples. I mean, the world basically has agreed with the action in Kosovo. The world basically has agreed with the attacks in Syria. Then it's up to, lawyers in particular, but others to determine, well, is that then, is that creating new law? Is it reinforcing law that exists, as I believe? Or is it just never going to fly? And if it's in that never going to fly category, boy, do you have a real problem with international law and international order? Because what are you going to do?
I think this is our first Intrepid Podcast law off.
It is a law.
We're going to have to link to Nicaragua case, the ICJ now, on the Twitter.
But, yeah, we always get the international relations folks in a spin at that point.
So it's like there's two listeners left now on this.
Well, hopefully. There's probably my wife and your wife.
My wife doesn't listen.
And they hear enough of this at home anyway.
I'm not sure I'm here now, right?
Okay. Yeah, poor Stephanie. Suffice to say, yes, I think it's, I think it's at least a reasonable argument to put forward. And I think if a matter like this ever, found its way to court, and I think it could, even in a domestic court, if you look at, people who might be serious to saying that Canada has committed or supported, maybe not in this case, but in a similar one like Kosovo, actual aggression, the crime of aggression, then go to your local constabulary, seriously, and lay a complaint, or to the war crimes folks here in Ottawa at DOJ, and say, and maybe one day, as always, a court will help, hopefully, clarify the law in that area. But
sounds like a reference case to Supreme Court, right?
Now
that we've dealt with
bigger. Hey, look, there's no it was a good decision today, I'll have to say, I guess.
No, it's terrible. That,
I know
that you require a humanitarian intervention.
Well, there you go.
I'm
getting my bottle opener now. I'm marching down the street. I think that's the very point, and I just worry that, if you're going to take, and again, with honestly, we're good friends, Craig, with the greatest respect, that you take the very, clear stance that in no way can this be justified under international law. I really do ask the practical question, especially as a guy that had to advise the government and the military, like, what do we do? What options do you have out there? I don't think you want to get forced down personally, more what I think are objectively more sort of cynical paths of saying the law doesn't matter. Or, yeah, we know it's illegal, but do it. I mean, you guys talked about those phrases, illegal but legitimate. I can't accept that. Right. It has to be legal to be legitimate, right, in my mind.
Well, I think you and I share the view that at the very least, the states who are supporting should be more expressive on the substance and scope and rationale.
Without question, and
I don't think IR scholars would object to that.
No, but I think IR scholars might know, a little bit more at times than legal advisors. And that was often a frustration as not only a legal advisor, but eventually the JAG as the head of an organization that's, professional organization is trying to encourage decision makers to come out and be more transparent about what they really think about the law. No greater example, and maybe you'll have me back to talk about, the detainee issue in Afghanistan, where there were certain individuals, viewed as international law experts in Canada talking about the law. And I actually think that they were, misstating the law. But having the opportunity to counter that is very tough if government itself doesn't want a necessary. And it has a myriad of reasons, of course, why it does. Some may be valid, some may not, because I'm just looking at it from a legal advisor's perspective. But I think, yeah, if we were to follow the UK pattern a bit more, then at least, because some of the concern about humanitarian intervention is really that slippery slope argument that, and I think you use your phrase, what's good for the goose is good for the gander. And I say, absolutely, absolutely. So if Russia can legitimately stand up and say this was a humanitarian intervention in the Crimea, and objectively meet
Georgia,
the criteria.
Georgia and Crimea was, well, if they can do it in Kosovo, we can do it in Crimea.
That's what they said. Yeah. But again, what ultimately...
It's lawfare.
It's a form of that. It's kind of, I think there's a wink and a nod approach from that. Because, otherwise, certain states like Russia, demonstrably do not comply with international law almost on any issue. And that's when you'll have to get into, maybe not a scientific, maybe more of an art balancing of, well, it looks like Canada and NATO and those countries are really trying hard here to comply with law. And these guys never, whether it's international trade or health issues or now, geopolitical, jus ad bellum, I'm going to, invade a country perspective. Sorry for the Latin there for listeners, but if we get behind something like humanitarian intervention as articulated by the UK, well then everybody has a common starting point. Because without that common starting point, you're just going to leave it wide open for states to make any statements they want that seem like some sort of justification for their activity. I think the less you can do, frankly, to maybe it's too strong of a word, to scare states away from engaging in having a public legal debate, I think that's a bad thing.
Right.
I think there should be more...
Because you're left with the unlawful but legitimate argument.
Which is completely...
Like unsustainable.
It makes no sense on ethical, legal...
I don't know that we disagree that much. I think we disagree on crystallization, right?
True. But lawyers will always do that. Because in the... Especially,
I didn't notice.
Well, I mean, you attended many classes when we were in London together, Stephanie.
Crazy,
and everybody, seems from time immemorial is trying to struggle with... when it's customary. I mean, how many times do you, when you actually think about it, and I mean that seriously, when somebody says, well, that's customary international law.
They don't do the math. They don't.
Do you go, well, is it really?
Well, I mean, think you have a mutual friend of ours, Hayes Parks, used to say, international law is what two professors agree over a cup of coffee.
Who cite each other.
Yeah, it's always better when you cite each other. But the quality backslapping helps develop the law. But seriously, I mean, that is always going to be the challenge. And fair enough, right? There should be debate. Mm-hmm. I just worry that sometimes, and it's a real balance, particularly again for legal advisors, that actually have to advise governments who are going to do something. And I think you alluded to that a little bit when you were speaking in that podcast, Craig, about the function of the Crown prerogative for the domestic authority,
right.
And can JAG lawyers how would they advise a government? Obviously, I can tell you firsthand from my own practice, both during the crisis moments, but even before then, we're constantly thinking of these scenarios and looking at the law. I mean, the law is not static, so we have to keep up on it. And so, I'm very confident that as JAG, and I'm sure the current JAG is the same boat, that our guys would not be advising, okay, on the one hand, you have domestic authority, the prerogative to deploy the troops. But if you don't have an international legal basis, the advice has to be, there's no legal basis to do this.
Right.
But that's different, and then saying, well, it's reasonably arguable that there may be a basis like, say, humanitarian intervention, where, I would feel confident going to a court or a Canadian court to say, here's the argument.
We're not going to end on unambiguously unlawful. Not unambiguously unlawful.
Not unambiguously illegal.
Oh, that's the UK Commission report.
That is Adam Roberts.
Sir Adam. Yeah. Yes.
Sir
Adam, yes. Roberts,
yeah.
Yes.
Which, look, I tried to end last week on just war theory. So,
I know. You guys twice were trying to end not on a downer, but it seemed like a downer at the end of it.
It's a downer. I just think it's a make work project.
Yeah.
It's a make work project for lawyers. But,
Well, no, but it's driven by, as often the law can be driven, it's by, decision and policymakers, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I said frequently with our policy folks, for the most part, policy is not the law. Many policy creators think there are, you know, policies above the law, and I constantly remind them it's not.
That's not great.
Well, it's when you come down to it, you know,
it's not great that policymakers think they're above the law.
Though. Well, it's only because, you know, there's almost that kind of realpolitik approach, right? Like, we're going to do this. And, you know, kind of the
so
law.
The
law.
Risk is not to mafia lawyer.
Exactly. Right. And so, but that was, you know, certainly unacceptable in my many years as a legal advisor, because, you know, the policy itself, you know, it may not have much in terms of legal, issues per se, but certainly the consequences of the implementation of that policy will. So why not, you know, get it right in the policy rather than trying to clean up the implementation piece of it. So I think honestly, there's a big voice from, you know, the IR, international relations world, and policymakers to, you know, say, okay, if we're going to try and push, you know, Canada's activities or NATO activities in this direction, we got to comply with the law. And, you know, it may sound trite to say that, but
it's the foundation of international law.
Yeah, in my many years, there weren't that many folks at a table that would, you know, other than the legal advisor, obviously, who would want to, you know, consistently say, well, you know, what about the law here? And I think that's another, you know, point we have to work on. And I think that helps.
That's a Norm Patterson problem.
Well, yeah. Let me talk about Patterson my next podcast. But that is a challenge because, you know, it has to come from the top.
And that's a happy note, Dan.
That's a happy note.
No, wait.
Thanks very much for coming in, Blaze.
Thanks, guys. It was great. I hope I can get back here.
Right. Cheers.
Cheers.
Cheers. Bye-bye.